get back to our argument for Christianity. And, like, keep your apologetics textbook handy in case you need to turn there. And, but the first one, absolute truth exists. How would you refute somebody who tells you that there is no absolute truth?
Is that true? Is that claim absolutely true?
Yeah, they're making any, we can't, we cannot, it's what Francis Schaeffer called antithesis. The idea that we speak in terms of truth and falsehood. If we make a truth claim, then we're saying the denial of that truth claim is false. And not only can we not communicate without antithesis, not only can we not communicate consistently with the denial of absolute truth, we can't even think consistently with the denial of absolute truth. So when you think in your mind, boy, this is a great day, you're basically saying the statement, this is a lousy day, is a false statement. Okay? When you think in your mind, okay, this Bible is black, then you're thinking, okay, the statement this Bible is red is a false statement. Okay? So when people say there is no absolute truth, that's a claim that it's absolutely true that there is no absolute truth. When I did a debate with Jim Corbett, who's the head of the Washington State Humanist Society, an atheist, and a guy from the audience stood up and he was really ticked off. He said, there are some things that you said that are absolutely false. And so I thought, you know, I don't even want to deal with this guy. Let me shut him down real quick. And he looked like a philosophy professor. Turned out to be a student. I knew he was just a student, I would have been a little bit more lenient. Because he was like in his like maybe late 30s, so I thought maybe he was a philosophy prof. He looked like one. He said, there's some things that you said in your opening statement that are just absolutely false. And I said, well, excuse me, sir, do you believe in absolute truth? And he said, what? I said, do you believe there's things that are absolutely true for all people at all times and all places? And he said, well, no. And I said, okay, well, then there's nothing I said that was absolutely false. And he's like, no, yeah, you said things were absolutely false. And it's like, it got to the point where we were going back and forth. The whole audience was laughing at the poor guy. And I said, sir, if there is no absolute truth, then there's nothing that I said in my statement that could possibly be absolutely false. And so this guy is like the only guy in the whole, you know, a couple hundred people, and he's the only guy who didn't get it. And, but it's like, you know, it's like, come on. I'm not a jerk, but you got to bring something to the table if you're going to take up some of my valuable time at a debate. And this idea that there, you know, there is no absolute truth. You know, it's say things like, there is no absolute truth, so we need to tolerate all views. Well, right there, they're proclaiming two absolute truths. They're claiming that the statement, there is no absolute truth, is absolutely true, and that we should tolerate all views is absolutely true. So, I mean, this is self-refuting. So what that tells us is that absolute truth must exist. Okay? You know, like the Hindu lady on the airplane that was sitting next to me, an elderly Hindu lady. I could tell just by the way she was dressed and the dot on her forehead that she was a Hindu. And so I was explaining the gospel message to her. She said, oh, yes, that's right. I agree with you. I said, no, you don't. She said, yes, I do. I said, ma'am, I'm telling you that Jesus is the only way to heaven. That anybody who doesn't trust in Jesus for salvation will end up in eternal conscious torment. And she said, oh, that's not true. It's like, you know.
Oh, that part's not true.
So it's just like, look, absolute truth must exist. But then you can say, okay, well, maybe absolute truth exists, But how do you know that we can know it? So maybe absolute truth exists, but man can't know it. But if they're going to claim that man cannot know truth, what's the problem with that?
You're assuming that you know everything to know, or...
You could probably move them in that direction, but I think it's even simpler than that. Just to claim that man cannot know truth is to claim to know the truth that man cannot know truth. So it's, you're making a truth claim. So it's like, if there's two things we know about reality, it's absolute truth exists and man can know it. So what that means is it is worthwhile to search for truth, okay? So absolute truth exists, man can know it. And then what we need to do is to argue for the existence of the infinite personal God. Now, the best argument that I've seen for the best argument that I've seen for God's existence is, in this handout, I don't even have it there, because most Americans just cannot grasp it. They can't get their mind around it. They're not Aristotelian enough in their thought. So Thomas Aquinas used it. So in this handout, it says God's existence, and the under rational arguments, contingent existence needs a necessary ground. Contingent existence needs a necessary ground. The way I would spell this out is like this. Like, you have contingent beings. It kind of means dependent beings. They're finite, limited beings. Okay. It means their existence is contingent or dependent upon something else.
Like a baby.
Yeah, the baby is dependent on other things, but we're dependent on air. We need air to breathe. We need food to eat. Okay? So let's suppose if atheism is true, let's just suppose, even beyond atheism, that everything that exists is contingent. Everything that exists is finite. Everything that exists is possible existence, meaning it has the possibility, it could possibly not exist. How do we know that we have the possibility of not existing? Do we have to exist? How do we know we don't have to exist? How do we know that it's actually possible for Phil Fernandez to not exist?
Because we have a beginning and an end. I mean, we're moral. I mean, not moral, but not immortal, but we're mortal.
Yeah, you can come at it from that angle. We come at it from the angle like, okay, if Phil Fernandez has to exist, why didn't I exist in 1957? Okay, I was born the first day of 1960. So, if there was a time when I did not exist, then it's possible for me to not exist. I mean, there was actually a time when I didn't exist. Okay? So that means I'm a contingent being. me coming into existence was contingent upon, you know, certain factors, like Joe Fernandez being attracted to Angelina Menichino, and them dating, him proposing, her saying yes, and then eventually they had a baby boy and named him Phil. And then, you know, and then again, there's the air for me to breathe, the food for me to eat, the water for me to drink. So, it is possible that I not exist, okay? So I'm a possible being. I'm finite, contingent being, okay? I'm limited being, I'm dependent being. I depend on something else for my continued existence. This, by the way, is Thomas Aquinas' third way to argue for God's existence. I think it's the most powerful way to argue for God's existence, although I stopped using it in debates on college campuses because we no longer teach kids to think critically, so it goes over their heads, okay? So we're not looking for, with Aquinas, we're not looking for the cause of the beginning of our existence. We're looking for the cause for our continuing existence. Why do finite, limited beings still exist right now? So let's assume that everything that exists is contingent or dependent or finite or limited or has the possibility of non-existence, okay? So this line represents everything that exists. Well, if given enough time, every possibility for non-existence will be actualized. Okay? If everything has the possibility of non-existence, okay, given enough time, every one of those possibilities for non-existence will be actualized. And so you can say, okay, well, let's just say that in our the Earth's atmosphere, if something happens to where the sun starts dying out or there's just not enough oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere, then we cease to exist, okay? And plant life ceases to exist. And but then you can say, yeah, but other planets do. Yeah, but then something else eventually gives out as a possibility of non-existence, and then the certain planets in our solar system can't exist, and eventually the galaxy. So basically, given enough time, every possibility for non-existence will be actualized, and then nothing will exist. Okay? If everything that exists has the possibility for non-existence, given enough time, every possibility for non-existence will be actualized and nothing will exist. But that means if you go backwards in time far enough, the same scenario would have obtained, where the possibility of the non-existence of everything will have been actualized. Yet, something now exists, and from nothing, nothing comes. So that tells us that something has to be. By the way, you could add to this list of being temporal, time-bound, changing. Okay? So the only way to ground the continuing existence of finite existence is to ground it with non-contingent being. And what non-contingent means is necessary being. A being that cannot not exist. A being that is totally independent, exists in its own power. A being that is infinite, not limited by anything outside itself, so it's unlimited. Doesn't have possible existence, it has necessary existence. It cannot not exist. It must exist, okay? And since it must exist, it would be eternal and unchanging. Okay? That's the only way to explain the continuing existence of finite beings. So if finite beings exist, or even if just one finite being exists, infinite being must exist to ground the continuing existence of finite being. Okay? And now what I like about this argument is where you go from that. You've just proven that God, unlike most arguments for God's existence, you've just proven that God is infinite, unlimited. So then we find out, okay, well then, infinite being, what must infinite being be like? Well, first off, there can only be one infinite being. Because if you had two infinite beings, they would limit each other, and then they wouldn't be infinite. They would be finite beings. And then they would need one infinite being to ground their existence. So we're right back at one necessary being. For two beings to differ, one being has to have a perfection that the other being lacks, or both beings have the same number of perfections, but one has at least one of their perfections to a greater degree than the other one. But infinite being, by definition, must have every possible perfection, and must have every possible perfection to an infinite degree. In other words, if you had two infinite beings, they would be identical. And being is what something is. Okay? God is one being. Being is what you must necessarily have to be that kind of being. We're human beings. We have what you have to have to be human beings. Okay? Infinite being has to have certain attributes, and basically, when you just figure out what it is, every possible perfection to an infinite degree, there's no way to differentiate an infinite being. It would have to be one infinite being. Okay? Infinite being, since it's infinite or unlimited, it cannot be limited by time, so it has to be eternal. It can't be limited by space, so it has to be omnipresent. It can't be limited by ignorance, so it has to be omniscient, all-knowing. It can't be limited by anything outside itself, so it must be omnipotent, all-powerful, okay? Cannot be limited by evil, so it must be all good, okay? So you start spelling out what an infinite being has to have. You're basically describing the God of the Bible, okay? By the way, if God is all-knowing, God's got to be personal. You can't have electricity is not personal. It doesn't know anything. To be all good, it has to be personal. Okay? So that's what I like about Aquinas' argument, that basically Aquinas is not trying to prove God's existence with rational necessity. He's trying to prove God's existence with existential necessity. He starts in existence, in human existence, which is finite existence. He And he argues, if anything finite, any limited being exists, then unlimited being must exist. So the idea that Aquinas is just arguing for God's existence beyond all reasonable doubt or a high degree of probability, no, it's an existential necessity. Now for him, logical necessity or rational necessity would be a vast emotion for God, because mathematical truths exist with rational necessity. You know, 4 + 2 must equal 6, but that doesn't tell us whether we have 6 apples or not. You haven't left the realm of ideas into the realm of existence. So Aquinas starts in the realm of existence, finite existence, and then argues infinite existence must exist. Aquinas would argue, if you start in the world of ideas, you'll always end up in the world of ideas. And so that's Aquinas' argument. Now, and it's a type of cosmological argument where you're arguing from the universe or something in the universe to God. An easier cosmological argument to know, but I don't think the force of the argument is as strong, but, you know, it's hard to use an argument that nobody understands anymore. But the Kalam cosmological argument Kalam is the Arabic word for time. Muslims love using this. I don't like that Christians act like we got this argument for God from the Muslims, because I believe that there were Christian scholars who predated the Muslims that used it. Now later on, 600 years after the start of Islam, Saint Bonaventure loved it. But basically, the Kalam cosmological argument everything that has a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning. Therefore, the universe needs a cause. Okay? So everything that has a beginning needs a cause, because it couldn't cause its own. If something had a beginning, it couldn't cause its own existence, because then it would have to pre-exist its own existence to bring its own existence about, and that's ludicrous. It's absurd. It had to be caused to come into existence by something else. And so everything that has a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning. We now know that from Big Bang cosmology. You could also philosophically argue for the beginning of the universe. If the universe did not have a beginning, then there would be an infinite number of moments throughout the history of the universe until you get to the present moment now. But you would never reach the present moment now, because no matter how many moments you traversed, you'd still have an infinite more number of moments to traverse. So I don't want to get into Zeno's paradoxes, but what he showed, he didn't realize what he was showing, but he was showing the impossibility of traversing an actual infinite set of finite points. And so basically, there's no way to get through an infinite set of finite events one step at a time, which is what it would take if the universe was eternal and we reach the present moment now. reach the present moment now, there had to be a first moment. Time had to have a beginning. So when God created the universe, He created not only space, matter, energy, but He also created time. Okay? And so the universe had to have a beginning, and the universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs to cause. Virtually no atheist right now will argue that the universe is eternal. Okay? I've had one atheist tell me that if the universe had a beginning, theism is more reasonable than atheism. However, what if science someday finds some invisible eternal source of all the energy in the universe? I said two things. Number one, then you'd have to stop calling your atheism scientific, because you're hoping what they might find 100 years from now. You're not basing your argument on what science now knows. Number two, what you call eternal, invisible source of all the energy in the universe, that's what I call God. So you're really not an atheist. Now the debate should be, is God personal or a non-personal force? But you basically just admitted to the existence of God. And so whatever the case, this is a strong argument. Now you can even argue further that if an eternal cause, so you have to have an uncaused cause of everything else that exists, and if this uncaused cause exists throughout all eternity and then makes a temporal effect, an effect in time that makes no sense for that uncaused cause to be non-personal. The reason for that is the only way you could explain an eternal being existing in one state and then creating a temporal realm, the only way you could explain that is by personal choice. That's why Benedict Spinoza ruled out miracles, because he believed God was a non-personal force, and a non-personal force doesn't make choices. It's non-personal. Only persons make choices. So God can't perform miracles. The laws of nature are the way they had to be, and they were that way throughout all eternity. So just to go from no universe to boom, a universe, shows us that the cause has to be personal. So, but if you just go with that, most people will just settle for that. That everything that has a beginning needs a cause, the universe had a beginning, so the universe needs a cause. Now, brilliant scientist, but philosophical, I'm trying to think of a kind word.
Lightweight.
A philosophical lightweight. Very good, very good. Every time I say ignoramus, everybody gets offended. So, philosophical lightweight, like Richard Dawkins, would say something then along the lines there. Well, then, you know, like, who designed the designer? So here he would say, well, then who caused the cause, the first cause? And what Richard Dawkins just doesn't get, because I don't think he wants to get it, we are not saying that there is a first cause because we want there to be a first cause. We're saying there's a first cause because our arguments say there has to be a first uncaused cause. So if the designer needed a designer, or the first cause needed a cause, and you just keep going on infinitely, then there's no explanation for anything existing. There has to be a first uncaused cause. There has to be eternal being, infinite being, to ground finite being in existence. Okay? So he just kind of ignores certain aspects of the arguments and then brings in an objection that has already been answered in in the argument.
Can you say that, to say that who caused the first cause? So who made God, basically, is what he's saying?
No.
Could you say that that's an assumption that you're making within the constructs of time that we live in? If you make a claim like that, you're assuming that God had a cause.
Yeah, if he's assuming that that everything has a cause, and I don't think he is, but I think he's assuming that we're assuming that everything has a cause. But no knowledgeable Christian thinker in the history of the church ever argued that everything needs a cause. We argue everything that has a beginning or everything that is finite needs a cause. And eventually you have to arrive at infinite being or eternal being, which by definition doesn't have a cause. And in other words, if you reject the God explanation, the so-called God hypothesis, then there is no explanation. So Richard Dawkins will do anything it takes. Well, the designer needs a designer. No, it doesn't, Richard. Maybe life started by something got on the back of a crystal. It's like, what are you talking about? So then he tells Ben Stein, okay, maybe aliens did it. Are you really going to shift your views that quickly? Is your worldview that weak that you have to resort to that? You sound like a kid, a third grader on a schoolyard. You know, my dad could beat up your dad. Oh yeah, my dad weighs 300 pounds and has six-pack abs. Okay, but my dad and his two brothers could beat up your dad. But my dad has brothers too. Okay, well then, it's just like, come on, get over it, man. Just deal with the arguments that we're giving. The arguments they were giving show that there has to be an uncaused cause. There has to be infinite being. And so to try to push it beyond God, so we're not saying, we're not positing the existence of God because we'd like God to exist. We're positing the existence of God in our arguments because he has to exist. If he didn't exist, nothing else would exist. And it's kind of like what these atheists are doing. It's kind of, first you get the invention of mathematics. Well, the invention of mathematics. We're actually thinking God's thoughts after him. We're discovering mathematics. And then we're putting these numbers and this data into these little machines called calculators. But eventually you get people who never did math on their own. And they think math is not made up of truths that exist outside that calculator. I had a guy who was studying to be he was in a law enforcement department with me, and he was studying to be an accountant. And he called me up at the gate I was at, working with the Sunbase police, and he said, do you have a calculator? I said, no. He said, you know anybody's got a calculator? I said, no, I don't. And I said, why, you got a math problem? He said, yeah, but it's a really tough one. I said, well, what kind of math problem is it? He said, addition. I said, you're kidding me. Addition? He said, yeah, but you don't understand. Each of these numbers is like 6 to 8 digits long. And there's 7 of them. I said, you're kidding me, right? He's like, no. You know anybody who's got a calculator? I said, give me the numbers. He said, oh, come on. Yeah, right. And I said, give me the numbers. He gave me the numbers. I wrote them down. I had them carried over wherever I had to carry over. And within a couple minutes, I told him what the answer was. He said, you're messing with me, Fernandez. And I said, look, write the number down. Find a guy who's got a calculator, and you'll see that the number is right, as long as assuming the guy punches the right buttons. So he called back a half hour later and he said, you jerk. I said, what do you mean? He said, you got a calculator. So even just with simple addition, I don't know calculus, simple addition, and this guy thought that this is all, it was almost as if it doesn't exist outside the calculator. So So if you don't have a calculator, you can't get... And that's what we're doing now, is for there to be a world, there has to be infinite being to bring about this world. And they just keep... Richard Dawkins just keeps looking at this physical world and acts like this is all there. All there is the calculator. There's no math outside the calculator. And so that's another form of... you know, the cause of the universe, the cause of the beginning of the universe. The design in the universe, this is what's called the teleological argument, from the Greek word telos, for end or goal or purpose. Teleological argument, argument from design. There's at least four different types. I mean, J.P. Moreland will come up with a list longer than that, but he's a lot smarter than me. I'm just going to go with four different types. It's kind of like William Paley's watchmaker argument. If you walk into the wilderness, you find a rock, you can explain how it got there without a supernatural cause. Technically, you can't. The Aquinas argument would say, you give me the existence of a rock, I'll give you God's existence. Okay, I'll prove God's existence. But you could say, well, natural causes produced this, designed this. But then you find a watch. Even if you never saw a watch before, you would look at it and how it works, and you would figure out that it's keeping time. You say, wow, there must be a watchmaker. Then William Paley goes and looks at the human eye and shows that the human eye is far more complicated and well-designed than a watch. If a watch must have a watchmaker, then a human eye must have a designer. And so you can argue from the design in the universe, okay, and the four ways specified complexity, irreducible complexity, the anthropic principle, Aquinas would say the mindless things of nature. Okay. So let's look at each of these different types of design. Specified complexity is the highly complex information that is found in the cell. And the cell is the most basic unit of life. The way scientists define life, you know, something that takes in energy from the outside and causes it to exist, it takes that energy, but the basic unit of life is the cell. And a cell contains enough genetic information to fill 20,000 volumes of encyclopedia. How do I know that? Because Richard Dawkins says so in his The Blind Watchmaker? Is that the name of his book? One of his books. And so basically, you're not going to get 20,000 volumes of encyclopedia by chance. Okay? In fact, if you had everything you needed to print a Webster's Dictionary, no matter how many explosions you have in a print shop, you're never going to accidentally produce a Webster's Dictionary. Now, the atheist argument is, given enough time, a monkey on a typewriter will eventually, if you just gave it enough time, life expectancy isn't long enough, but you give it a few billion years, and a monkey on a typewriter would eventually type all of Shakespeare's plays. Okay? That is science fiction. Okay? That's not science. In fact, an Israeli scientist actually did an experiment on that, but computer keyboards with a printer and all in a monkey cage and just let the monkeys go at all these different keyboards for an entire month. And more times than not, they use the keyboards as a toilet bowl. So that was the most likely thing for them to do. But after 30 days, they produced so many pages of data, yet not even one word. Now, when I heard that, I thought, okay, but he doesn't mean single letter words. But then I read the guy's paper, and the guy's saying, hey, wait a minute. If it's the word up, it has to be a small a with a space before it and a space after it. There is no up. If it's I, it has to be a capital I with a space before it and a space after it. Nowhere to be found. So these monkeys are having a hard enough time spelling single letter words. Okay, so it just didn't happen. And it wouldn't happen no matter how much time you had. See, the further you go on, when there's no intelligence, the further you go on, the more disorder you get. See, you know, I was looking around at this church on the way to the restroom, and I went into the soundproof room, and I just looked at that beautiful sanctuary. This is an old church. This has been very well kept. Okay? Though believe me, we've looked at churches that there's been nobody in that church for like 10 years. And it smells, it looks ugly, you know. You got to really use your imagination. And the idea that things move from disorder to order just naturally is baloney. It takes intelligence to take a state of disorder to bring about a state of order. It's one of the reasons why evolutionists don't talk about the Big Bang as an explosion much anymore. Because it's like when I asked Dan Barker, give me an example of an explosion that produced more order and more complexity. Explosions take things from a state of order and complexity and bring it to a state of disorder. But it's intelligence that moves everything out. So it's kind of like, it's always like the law of thermodynamics, energy deterioration is at work, and only intelligence can combat that. And but at specified complexity, you're not going to get 20,000 volumes of encyclopedia by accident. So if you had a print shop, no matter how many explosions you have, you're never going to accidentally produce one volume of encyclopedia, let alone 20,000 volumes. Irreducible complexity. Michael Behe from Lehigh University, a scientist who's a nominal Catholic, he wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. Darwin's Black Box. A black box in science is something that scientists talk about, but they've never really looked into it. They just didn't have the technology to look into it. And the molecule was that way. Darwin, in Darwin's day, back in the 1860s, we were not able to look into molecules and see how they worked. So it was Darwin assumed that molecules are very simple. So when, you know, humans are molecules in motion, we look really complex, but we're just a bunch of simple molecules thrown together. Well, the fact of the matter is that's wrong. You know, in the past 150 years, we now looked at the submolecular level, and we found entities, says Michael Behe, that are as complex as spaceships or computers, but they're irreducibly complex. In other words, picture a spaceship or a computer, but you remove one part and it ceases to function. So it's not like something evolved into this. Things as entities on the submolecular level, as complicated, as complex as spaceships or computers, had to be created that way. Because to be any less complex, and they wouldn't exist long enough to evolve into something else. Okay? So that's irreducible complexity. The anthropic principle, from the Greek word anthropos for man, says that when scientists look at our solar system, or when they look at the universe as a whole, it appears the universe and the solar system appear as if they were fine-tuned or designed for the purpose of supporting human life on the planet Earth. Okay? If there was no Jupiter in our solar system, we wouldn't be here today. Jupiter, just about every day, takes on asteroids. Asteroids get caught in the gravitational pull of Jupiter and get destroyed either on Jupiter's surface or even before, just entering its atmosphere. Yet these asteroids would destroy all life on the planet Earth if they ever hit. It's like the ultimate offensive lineman protecting the quarterback Earth. If we didn't have the right size moon with the right size, the right shape, and the right distance, and the right revolution around the Earth, we'd all drown in tidal waves. Okay? If the sun were a little closer, we'd all fry to death. If we were a little further away, we'd all freeze to death. And but you could also change the chemical composition on the far reaches of the universe just by 1 or 2%, and there would be no life on the planet Earth today. So the parameters for life on the planet Earth, whether looking at our solar system or the universe itself, appear to be fine-tuned for the purpose of supporting human life on the planet Earth. So that's the anthropic principle. That's what science tells us. Okay? So I think what we can conclude from that is that the universe was designed or fine-tuned to support human life on a planet Earth. However, scientists don't like that. So what they then do is they come up with their own and form of the anthropic principle. So they explain why it appears to be that way, but it really isn't. And they do a lot of wild speculation that's usually very far separated from actual science. Got to the point where old Earth creationists, the Christian Hugh Ross, an astrophysicist, he said that when you look at these old alternative anthropic principles, he says they're completely ridiculous. So he calls them the completely ridiculous anthropic principle. Well, he purposely put it together because the acronym tells you his low view of these anthropic principles. And so whatever the case, even Richard Dawkins acknowledges that the universe appears as if it was designed. But he said, then says in his The God Delusion, but that's an illusion. But where's the scientific evidence? If our five senses, that's how you do science, through sense perception, if our five senses tell us that the universe was designed, then why not accept that? And to just call it an illusion, Richard Dawkins is showing his true colors. He doesn't like, when science leads him into the throne room of God, he just rejects it, calls it an illusion, and then acts like he's still being scientific, but he's left the realm of science. And then Aquinas would say, we see the mindless things of nature constantly moving towards the same goals. So apple seeds producing apple trees, acorns producing oak trees, okay? And he says, if they're mindless, they're not directing themselves. What is directing them? And so he argues there must be a mind governing the mindless things of nature to bring about the same result. So he's basically arguing from the laws of nature, the patterns in nature, that there must be an intelligent designer that set those things in motion or works through those things to bring about those results. Okay, anybody have any questions on the design argument?
Would the laws of thermodynamics be a design argument, or would it actually fall under one of those subcategories?
I think you can take, there's probably ways of using them in design, but I would use it more for a cosmological type argument. And then I would say that the, like the first law of thermodynamics, energy conservation, the amount of energy remains constant. There's no energy being created or destroyed. A lot of atheists will say, well, that disproves Christianity. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. No, that's not what it said. The first law of thermodynamics is saying no energy is now being created or destroyed. But when you couple with that the second law of thermodynamics, that as energy changes forms, it becomes less and less usable. So we're running out of usable energy. So there's going to be, unless there's intervention from the outside, from God, there's going to be an end of the universe. Well, all the energy in the universe will have been used up. But that means you move backwards in time, you reach a point where all the energy in the universe was in a useful state, and that would mark the beginning of the universe. So the second law tells us there had to be a beginning of the universe. So if no energy is now being created or destroyed, but it all had a beginning, that tells us that there has to be a creator. There had to be a cause. And so I think when you couple the two of them, you can get real lot. Now, there are ways to go for design there, but you'll need a lot more scientific knowledge than I have. Now, the moral argument, we all make moral value judgments. Okay? So the guy said, look, there's no such thing as right and wrong. It's right for you, it's right for you. It doesn't have to be right for me and vice versa. But then they'll turn around and say, now you Christians are wrong wanting to share your political views in the public schools. Well, wait a minute, there's no such thing as right and wrong. Christians are never wrong. Leave us alone. So everybody acts like moral laws exist. You can deny morality, but you're human. You're a moral being. You have to live. Even Hitler lived in the realm of morality. His views were so warped. What he thought was good was evil. What he thought was evil was good. But he still lived with the categories of good and evil. C.S. Lewis points out everybody acknowledges evil when they're the victim of the wrong. So there's no such thing as right and wrong until somebody robs you. And then you want justice. And I knew a guy who denied absolute morality. It was the Subbase Police, and he was a graduate of Penn State, got his degree in criminal justice. I said, criminal justice? Justice means there is such a thing that is right, and criminal means there's guys who don't do what is right, and some of them commit crimes, and we should lock them up for doing the wrong thing. And he just went back and forth and all this other stuff. And he was a single guy, so I said, what if some evil guy raped your wife? And so he said, well, I wouldn't like that, but it wouldn't really be wrong. And I thought, this guy's a baloney maker here. So what I did was I was supposed to check a certain amount of buildings. And then he's supposed to relieve me. I relieve him at the gate, and he's supposed to check. You know, so I'm supposed to do about one-third of the buildings. He's supposed to do one-third. Another guy, one-third. So I only checked in that I did like one-tenth of the buildings. And I turned it over to him, and he was ticked. He was screeching in a police vehicle, screeching his vehicle, going through my gate, driving, wouldn't even stop, because he was ticked off because I did an injustice. And so finally I weighed him down to a stop after he's driving around throwing a tantrum and all this other stuff. I say, hey, look, smart guy, look. He was a big guy too, but he was getting on my nerves, so. And I took the clipboard and I said, hey, stop speeding all over the place. You're a cop. You should know better. And I said, and here's a checklist. You should have looked underneath. These are the checks I really did. He said, well, then why'd you only list those up there? And so he said, whoa, what's the matter? Do you feel like I wronged you? Did I do some kind of injustice to you? I thought there's no such thing as right and wrong. And then I told him, if you can't live consistently with your worldview, you need a new worldview. You need to trash your worldview. And so we all recognize, I'm not saying, walk up to the guy and say, well, there's such a thing as right and wrong. I said, no, there isn't. I'm not saying, okay, punch him in the nose. you know, to prove your point, because you're going to go to jail. But the fact of the matter is, everybody deep down inside, if they're honest, they'll acknowledge there is right and wrong. Okay? You could ask people, is torturing innocent children, is that wrong? They say, well, I don't like it, but is it wrong? No, it's not really wrong. Well, just based on that alone, trash your worldview. I spoke at Olympic College back in the early 1990s. I was debating two students, just an informal debate in front of the crowd during the Q&A. And I said, they said each society just determines what is right and what is wrong. And so I said, okay, well then, if society determines what is right and what is wrong, then another society can't condemn it. Actually, they said, right, that's right. So I said, so in the 1850s in the South, if people were putting a whip to the back of another man just because of the color of his skin and enslaving him and not giving him his freedom, that there was nothing wrong with that in the 1850s in the South. And these guys said, and it was a mixed crowd too. And these guys, two white guys, they said, yep, that's right, it wasn't wrong. And I said, based on that alone, if your worldview is so lame that it can't condemn that as evil, I would trash my worldview right then and there and become a Christian for no other reason than that. And so the moral argument, I think you say, oh, like, all right, we all make moral value judgments, but the individual decides, each individual. Problem is, if each individual decides, then we can't call Adolf Hitler wrong. But everybody wants to call Adolf Hitler wrong. So they might say, okay, well then maybe it's beyond the individual, maybe it's each society determines what is right and what is wrong. Okay, but then one society like America can't condemn another society like Nazi Germany. We can't condemn it as being wrong. Okay, but we all want to condemn the Taliban, Nazi Germany, the old Soviet Union. So they might say, okay, well maybe it's the world consensus. Okay? Look, the world consensus used to be that a woman was property of the man. Slavery was perfectly permissible. Okay? So the world consensus has been miserably wrong in the past. You're trying to change, the atheists are trying to change, the moral relativists are trying to change the world consensus right now. Okay? And then, they condemn the past and the present and try to build a better future. By the way, in my The God Who Sits Enthroned, Evidence for God's Existence book, we've got all these arguments spelled out there. But so they condemn the past and the present, and they try to build a better future. See, what they're doing, when you make a moral value judgment, you're appealing to a standard, okay? Basically, a moral law. So even the moral relativists, when they're protesting for animal rights or gay rights or whatever it is, they're appealing to a standard above all individuals, above all societies, above any world consensus, and they're acting like the standard does not change with time, because they condemn the past and the present, they're trying to build a better future. What that tells me is I don't care what they say they believe, they're acting as if they're appealing to a standard above all individuals, since they're appealing to a standard that's above all individuals, all societies, any world consensus, and the standard doesn't change with time, the only explanation for that, since moral laws are prescriptive, they prescribe the way things ought to be, there has to be a prescriber, what that tells me is there's got to be they're acting as if there's a moral lawgiver above all individuals, all societies, any world consensus, and the moral lawgiver doesn't change with time. Okay? So, you get a chance, read that chapter on the moral argument, and and hopefully it'll sink in. But if there is no God, it's like Dostoevsky wrote, I'm not even sure I know how to pronounce his name, but Brothers Karamazov, if God does not exist, all things are permissible. If God does not exist, all things are permissible. Okay? So what people do is they'll reject the God of the Bible, but then they have to live on borrowed capital from the Christian worldview because the atheist bank account is empty. And this is what Nietzsche said, we got to stop doing this, guys. So if your worldview, the only way to make a worldview livable is to live as if Christianity is true. Okay? And so that's the moral argument. C.S. Lewis used the moral argument in his Mere Christianity, in his book Miracles. He used his argument from reason. And see if I have that one. You turn to this page here. You see the argument from human reason. And the atheist view is that human reason evolved into existence without any rational causes. Well, if that's the case, if human reason doesn't have a rational cause, what makes us think that our reason actually works? So we have no reason to trust in our reason if our reason got here by accident, if our reason got here by non-rational causes. However, Christianity says that human reason comes from a rational God, so it's not surprising that our reason works. So C.S. Lewis used that. He said the only way to really trust in the validity of human reason is to acknowledge the existence of reason with a capital R. Okay? And meaning in life, if there is no God and no judgment, punishment, or rewards, then it makes no difference whether you live your life like Mother Teresa and tried to help innocent people, or like Adolf Hitler and tried to slaughter innocent people. If God does not exist, life is absurd. Okay? Now, if God exists, then life has eternal meaning. It makes an eternal difference, not just how we live our lives, but even how we think. This is the oldest argument for the absurdity of life without God. Is Ecclesiastes, Solomon's work, that when you look at everything under the sun, if you don't put God in the equation, everything is without meaning. But if you put God in the equation, even our thoughts take on eternal significance. And I'll close with one more argument. Human rights. In a world without God, there is no basis for human rights. Man is mere molecules of motion. If I kick him around the dirt, nothing wrong with it. If I kick a human being, nothing wrong with it. But the atheist acknowledges human rights, so they don't live consistently with the worldview. If God exists and he created us in his image, then human life is of tremendous value and is deserving of rights. And so what we looked at so far, absolute truth exists, man can know truth, and there is very strong evidence for the existence of an infinite personal God. Take Aquinas' argument into account. If finite beings exist, then, and they do, then infinite being has to exist. Infinite being must exist. I would argue that an infinite personal God must exist. And we'll look at the deduction here.